So New Zealand is a very, quite frankly, lucky country in terms of poultry. We, to the best of my knowledge, we are unique in that we do not have and have never had highly pathogenic avian influenza of any strain. We have never had Newcastle disease of any strain. And we don't currently have infectious bursal disease type 1 of any.
We want to thank the innovative companies and products whose support and trust make this podcast possible.
AccuGut C.1 is a proven solution for your coccidiosis toolbox. Give those traditional tools a break and rotate to AccuGut C.1. Visit dsm-firmenich.com/AccuGut to learn more. AB Vista, intelligent nutritional solutions to boost poultry health and performance. Natural Biologics is looking deeper to find the natural solutions to your poultry health challenges. Nexus, powered by SAM, where science meets performance. Sid Lines, an Ecolab company, AV Prime program offers a broad range of cleaning and disinfection solutions combined with tailored advice to improve hygiene on your farm or hatchery.
Welcome to the Poultry Podcast Show. Today I'm here with Michael Brooks. Welcome.
Hello.
I'm really excited to talk to you today about something specific to New Zealand. But first, I would love to hear, how did you get into the poultry industry?
The reason I became the executive director of the Poultry Industry Association and the Egg Producers, the trade associations for the two industries, is that I actually have a law degree. And I started off many years ago working in industrial relations law with the trucking industry, and they invited me to join their trade association. And so from there, I've worked for the trucking industry, the retail industry, the red meat industry, so sheep and beef, and the former CEO of the poultry industry, when he was retiring, he had worked for the red meat industry, and he knew me from there and encouraged me to apply. I knew nothing about poultry. I applied, and I thought to myself, I'll work in this role for 5 years, and here I am 22 years later.
Oh, my gosh. We sucked you in.
Yeah. When I left the red meat industry working for them, they kept saying to me, you've moved to the dark side. They were not happy. But it has been a lot of things, but it's never been dull.
Yeah. Oh, man, that is so interesting. Excuse me. So many different industries there that you've spent some time in. So, oh, man. So I want to hear a little bit about what you do with the association and maybe some things that the association does for the producers in the area.
Okay, so like all the trade associations, our role, particularly engaging with industry, so industry regulators and what is called our Ministry for Primary Industries, so on things like food safety, animal welfare, import standards, those are the sort of topics we talk to a range of regulators. We can talk to the government ministers or the purely political side, but most of the time it's actually talking to the regulators, and that's for the poultry meat industry, separately again for the commercial egg industry, and actually we look after another organisation within the office, which is our New Zealand animal feed industry, the people that make feed for chickens and turkeys, ducks, pigs, etc. So it's a small office. There's just myself and a gentleman called Kerry Mulqueen, who's a qualified veterinarian, and then we have four part-time staff. So they keep us working.
Oh, that's great. So since our audience really is international, can you tell us just a little bit about the egg and the meat industries in New Zealand so maybe people can kind of like compare and contrast with their own?
Okay, so I'll start with the egg industry. So the size of the national flock is about 3.9 to 4 million birds at any one time. It's Interestingly, there's about what we call commercial farms, which is anyone probably with 1,000 birds or more. There's about 150 of those farms, but if you could genuinely say that there's probably 18 players in the industry who produce probably 90% of the eggs, and then you have a whole lot of little players, but they're very small, so they would supply to their local cafeteria or the local stores. So it's funded by what is called a commodity levy in New Zealand. So that's a piece of legislation that allows an industry to vote. So the farmers vote and they say, for the next 6 years, we'll allow a levy to be collected, and it's collected on the sale of day-old chicks, and that levy is then paid to the office. And that's how we run the Egg Producers Federation and do the work for them. About 65% of that income goes to our marketing arm, which markets eggs. You know, an egg a day is now okay. There is no cholesterol, those sorts of things. So that's the, and it has its own board. So that's the Egg Producers Federation. As I say, separately, we look after the poultry industry, and that's the trade association that looks after primarily chicken, but also producers of turkey and duck. Now, for New Zealand, turkey is just not a big dish. There's only two turkey suppliers. Duck has grown a little, has grown a bit in recent years. Mostly due, I guess, to increasing Asian immigration, so they like duck. But it's still tiny. Probably turkey and duck are only 3% of our poultry market. The rest is chicken. So it's very chicken-dominated. And we have primarily four companies in New Zealand. The largest one is Tegel, T-E-G-E-L. That was bought a couple of years ago by Bounty, the big Filipino chicken company. Then there is Ingham's New Zealand, which is part of the Ingham's Australia company, so they have a New Zealand branch. And then there's two smaller companies called Brinks, or Vanden Brinks, and Turks. And they're both, as some people recognise, Dutch names. And it's interesting in New Zealand, from about the 1950s and 60s, there was a bit of migration to New Zealand from Holland. It was pretty small. But interestingly, a number of those people got into the poultry industry. And so at one point, our layer industry, 50% of the layer farmers were of Dutch descent. And while it's less percentage now, it's still very much so names like Turks, Vandenbrinks, Dijkstra's, et cetera. And interestingly, Turks and Vandenbrinks, both family started in layers but have become meat chicken suppliers. So that's, and it's funded on a, it's voluntary to belong, but it's funded on a basis where we look at what tasks have to be done and then the companies pay a percentage of what that budget is based on their market size. And the PAN's board is made up, as it happens, of the four CEOs of those four key companies.
Oh, sure. Yeah. So what are some of the, I guess, the big ticket items going on right now, other than just marketing the meat or eggs that you're responsible for? I don't want to say lobbying, but, you know, promoting or educating.
Couple of things. I'll start with highly pathogenic avian influenza. So New Zealand is a very, quite frankly, lucky country in terms of poultry. We, to the best of my knowledge, we are unique in that we do not have and have never had highly pathogenic avian influenza of any strain. We have never had Newcastle disease of any strain. And we don't currently have infectious bursal disease type 1 of any, although we did have an outbreak a few years ago on one large layer farm, and to this day, no one knows how it happened. The most most popular view, or unpopular view, I guess, depending on how you see it, was that it was a mislabeled vaccine, and that's how it happened. But we identified it, we did a nationwide check, and it was eliminated. And actually, we had infectious bursal disease prior to that, about 20 years before that. And so ever since and still currently, we test every shed on every farm, meat, chicken and layers, for presence of infectious bursal disease, and we haven't found it.
Wow.
So what that leads to, that freedom from disease, is that we have import barriers to raw chicken and shell eggs on the basis that we don't want to bring those in. And it does enable us to export to Australia, and Australia has very strong barriers to poultry importation, but they can't deny New Zealand exports because they can't claim there's a disease risk. So export isn't a big deal for us. We export eggs and meat, chicken to the Pacific Islands, so Fiji, Samoa, Tonga, etc. There's a bit of egg export to places like Singapore and Hong Kong, and the same for same for meat, chicken. Again, Pacific Islands, Papua New Guinea, a little bit to Australia, a bit to United Arab Emirates, actually. So I'll move from that. So that's, that disease status has been very important. For 20 years, our ministry here has tested migratory birds from the Northern Hemisphere for bringing, potentially carrying, highly pathogenic avian influenza, and it's never been found in those migratory birds. Is that why? It's probably potentially due to the fact that if the migratory birds from the Northern Hemisphere, say Siberia or Japan, are coming down, if they have got highly pathogenic avian influenza, they probably die on the way. But we've never found it.
Yeah. What
has happened in New Zealand is that H5N1 strain, the strain that's causing such grief in USA with dairy and other things, we know at the end of last year it spread down through South America and crossed from South America into Antarctica. Now, we know it's in that part of Antarctica close to Argentina and Chile. Because it's now winter, we don't know how far it spread along the Antarctic coast. Has it got to the part of Antarctica directly south of New Zealand? That we don't know, and we probably won't know until spring, so September, October. And if it has, could potentially birds from the south come north to New Zealand and that way bring H5N1 strains. And that is causing real panic, as you can imagine, to our poultry industry, because we're pretty naive. It's also quite a big deal for New Zealand, because New Zealand was an interesting country prior to the arrival of man, before Maori arrived in New Zealand from Pacific Islands to the north, and about 800 years ago. New Zealand's native fauna was all avian, all birds. There were no mammals.
Really?
Totally avian. So there's a real fear, probably very much justified, I would imagine, that there'd be a very naive native bird flock, and H5N1 would not just do real damage to the poultry industry, but to our native birds. So I like to describe it, we're currently in peacetime, we're trying to prepare for wartime. I think a number of people recognise how serious it is. It has been a little frustrating trying to get across, particularly to smaller free-range farms, that they are incredibly vulnerable. And I guess the issue is, what do you do for biosecurity for H5 if it's wild birds and you've got a free-range farm? How do you stop that? Just about impossible, really.
Yeah.
So there's been outbreaks, not of H5, but H7 and H9 in Australia. We've liaise very closely with our counterparts in Australia and with our counterparts in the UK. I used to engage a bit with the American chicken industry, particularly when a gentleman called George Watts was there. I think he's long retired now, but he was a couple of times I've been to Washington, and he was just fantastic in terms of sharing resources. So I always think that's really good, maintaining your relationships with those other industry organisations. And with both the International Poultry Council and the International Egg Council. And I think both of those organisations do a lot of work. So going back to the H5N1, we're working with our ministry. It has proven to be a tortuous process. We have sent industry and MPI people both to the UK just back this week and to Australia prior to that to look at their outbreaks and see what we can learn, but there's still a lot of work to do. So it's a fairly frightening prospect for us.
Oh my gosh! Yes, the prevalence of HPAI around the rest of the world is incredible. So I am honestly impressed at the resilience of New Zealand to not have had to deal with it yet. But I totally understand the fear.
Yeah, I mean, we always have had good biosecurity on farm for that reason, but, you know, to an extent, we'd have to openly acknowledge it's a bit of luck based on our geographical position. Sometimes we feel like we're at the far end of the earth, and probably for people in Europe and North America, we are, but sometimes yeah. There's an upside to that. So that's yeah. What the upside is. Moving to animal welfare. So on the layer industry side, back in 2004, we have in New Zealand what are called codes of welfare. So there's an Animal Welfare Act, and under that act, a advisory body called the National Animal Welfare Advisory Committee, or NAWAC for short, they are charged, they are groups of experts, so it has animal welfare experts. It always has the SPCA, the Society for Protection of Animals representative. It always has a Federated Farmers representative, so that's the organisation that generally looks after farming in New Zealand. But we are not a member because it's really a pastoral industry. It really represents dairy and beef and sheep farmers and grain farmers, but not us. So, and then there's other people. And what happens is they develop codes of welfare, which set out a series of standards. And what that means is that if a government inspector or goes onto a farm to address maybe a complaint or something they've heard about, they can say to the farmer, we think you may have breached the act, and the farmer can say, I meet all the standards set out in the code, and therefore it acts as a defence. So it's a defensive sort of set of regulations rather than a proactive, although there is a move to steadily increase where a prosecution can be made on a breach of that code. So what happened back in until 2004, we were allowed to have the old-style cages, what people call, activists call battery cages, you know, four or five birds, nothing in the cage, belts, et cetera. So that was about 85% of the industry. There was free range, and barn really didn't exist. So, but that code said you have to get exit out of the old-style cages. And it would vary a bit depending on the age, but every farmer had to be out of those old style cages by the end of 2022. And that has happened. Mm. So there are no longer the old style cages in New Zealand. Wow. The options that were available were free range, where the stocking density is a maximum of 2,500 birds a hectare outdoors, barn, which was tiny in New Zealand, but, you know, birds housed inside, maybe with an internal aviary system. And that has grown a lot. And then colony cages or enriched cages. And so what has happened is that about 35% is now free range, about 33% is colony, and the rest is barn. What happened here was about 3 years ago, and we only have two big supermarket chains, they said as from 2026, we're not going to take colony eggs, eggs produced in colony systems. And by that stage, a number of farmers had transferred out of the old style cages into colonies because they had the shedding, et cetera. So that looks incredibly ironic now with the potential threat of HPAI, because these supermarkets only wanted free range or barn, and they're suddenly not potentially not going to have enough eggs. So that's, and that decision together with the code led a couple of years ago to a situation where our flock was decreasing and suddenly we had a shortage of eggs, and we've really only come, so the flock shrunk to about 3.3 million instead of 4, and so there were shortages of eggs. So it's come back. So that's on the meat chicken layer side. It's going to be really interesting in the next couple of years where that goes, particularly with the supermarket domination of egg sales. On the meat chicken side, so we have a maximum stocking density of 38 kgs per square meter. The sheds are concrete floors with litter, which is removed after each run. So that it's quite sought after by farmers as a really great fertilizer, actually. For codes, reviews of both of those codes are coming up probably next year. It's been meant to happen for about 2 or 3 years now, but it's happening the next year. So we're working away as to making our submissions to that independent advisory group on what changes may happen.
How frequently are those codes reviewed?
And about every 8 to 10 years.
8 to 10. Does your group or producers group, do you get to provide feedback, or are these like final changes?
No, very definitely we do. But it's very much a case of activist groups. So we have an animal activist welfare activist group called SAFE, Save Animals from Exploitation. That would be equivalent, I guess, to PETA in the States. So they can make submissions to our disgruntlement, I should say. But SPCA, et cetera. So, yeah, everybody has that option. So that's important work coming up for us over the next few months. Not good timing along with preparation for avian influenza, but that's life generally, isn't it? You can never control what's coming at you.
No, I'm so intrigued by the split of where the birds were housed, the hens were housed after conventional cages were outlawed, if you will. We have some different groups that did work on the different housing systems in the United States, and we pretty much skipped right over enriched colony and went straight to the aviary or the, you know, the barn type as the option instead. So the colony cages, though, are so interesting and so useful for different ways, but they still get perceived as a cage. So it's really interesting.
it was quite a tension within our egg producers board, and there were some people on the board who did say, let's just trump free range and barn. They went with the colony system. Look, it may be if highly pathogenic avian influenza came to New Zealand, it would seem like a pretty sensible idea. But, yeah, you're right. There's a lot of that phrase, a cage is a cage is a cage, is a difficult one to deal with when you're trying to debate in the media with activists, et cetera. So we'll see how that pans out. on the meat chicken side, as I say, our standards, actually for both meat and layers, our standards are very much in line with the EU standards. So we'll see what happens from there.
Yeah.
The other big issue for us, I guess, is food safety.
Oh, sure.
And on salmonella, we're astonishingly good. We have incredibly low levels of salmonella.
Wow.
And in both eggs and meat. We did have, and we don't know where it came from, about 2.5 years ago, we had an outbreak for the first time of salmonella enteritis. We'd never had that before. And one of the problems was it got into one of the hatcheries. And so there was a period of time when birds from the hatcheries carrying salmonella enteritis were going out to farms. And, of course, some people were saying, well, these farms have poor biosecurity. But actually it was a bit like a Trojan horse. It was inside something that you thought was safe, but it was actually bringing it. So a fair bit of work, testing again every farm, and over a period of about 6 months we managed to wipe it out and it hasn't returned. So that's good. So we've always been good on salmonella. We have a major problem with Campylobacter.
Oh.
Campylobacter, as I understand it, and I'm not an expert by any means, it thrives in warm, moist climates. And fundamentally, that's what New Zealand is. It's a pretty temperate, but pretty moist climate. And so Campy is everywhere in our environment. And it was back in 2006, we had really high levels of human Campylobacter, like much higher than the rest of the world.
Wow.
400 recognized cases per 100,000, when most countries it's less than 100.
Wow.
Now, at the time, and it turned into a media firestorm, and the industry came under huge pressure. And we were flummoxed because our processing could be better, so we have water, chlorine in spin chillers as our option, and we knew we could be better in our processing plants, but because we had an Australian Ingham's plant here, they could compare with their plants in Australia, and the results were broadly similar. Yet Australia had far less human cases, so to this day we still don't understand why, but there's a thought that it was a particular strain that didn't help because the strain seemed to change. But we've done a huge amount of work since then. We went to the government or the ministry and said, what can we do? We said, we're going to voluntarily adopt a benchmarking system and each plant will share what its results and primary processing are and how they're reducing it. And the then head of the food safety section of the primary industry body said, that's a great idea, but I tell you what, I'm going to make it mandatory, which wasn't quite the result we were looking for. And basically what it means is that if for 12 weeks in a row you haven't met a certain level of processing outcome, government can shut your plant down as a food safety risk.
Oh,
so that certainly focused the mind, shall I say, of the companies. And we have dramatically since just, and the human case numbers have dropped by 75 to 80%.
Wow.
Our processing standards are incredibly good in the systems that we can provide. So we measure to a level of 2 logs must be below 2 logs. And now we're at a point where it's almost, we can't, we're getting to a sort of point where it's saying that we're almost free. So we're looking at working on centrifuge to try and improve the pickup of Campy if it's available. But the government is always putting pressure to reduce those human cases. We've just met their latest standards, but it still remains a really big issue. And I've got to say, we look at the figures in the United States and we go, how do they do that? So We've done a lot of work looking at the States and the UK and Australia.
Yeah.
We've got better and better, but we just seem to be it being around in the environment is tough. And certainly as the growth in meat chicken free range has grown, it makes it even harder. And we know because we do testing, seeker testing on all the birds, we know that generally the free range birds are 100% detection rate for campy because they've caught it when they're outdoors.
Yeah. Oh man. Well, I mean, other than some of the rates still being higher, probably due to some geographical, it sounds like it overall a success to reduce incidents that much. I mean, that's incredible.
Yeah. It is a really good outcome. And then probably the last big thing in terms of the industry is we actually received an award recently from our National Veterinary Association because we no longer use antibiotics on a prophylactic basis. For recent years, we've always had a policy of never using highly or critically important human antibiotics as defined by the World Health Organization, using them on a prophylactic basis in our industry. We did have an antibiotic called zinc bacitracin, which used for gut diseases, but it was agreed by the companies that we would cease using that prophylactically. So that meant our antibiotic use has dropped. Because that was overwhelmingly the one we used, it's dropped by about 95%, we now believe we are maybe neck and neck with Denmark as the lowest user of antibiotics in the poultry world. Yeah. Still use coccidiostats, but not antibiotics. And there may be occasions where an antibiotic that's also used for humans may be used on a therapeutic basis in a chicken flock. But again, I think with that whole disease profile, we've been lucky.
Yeah.
So that's a whole range of the things that I can think of.
Heck yeah. That was wonderful. Are there, are there any big points or things you wanted to highlight before we wrap up our chat?
No, I guess I think worldwide this H5N1 it's completely changed that whole perspective of poultry, isn't it? Which is so worrying when you look at poultry. I mean, greenhouse gases is another one in this country. New Zealand's very odd worldwide because over 50% of our greenhouse gases come from agriculture.
Oh, wow.
From ruminants. And so, you know, the cattle industry, the dairy industry, so that's quite a plus for the chicken industry. So the government here has a sort of greenhouse gas scheme. The new government has just said agriculture won't be part of it. The previous government wanted to make them part of it. And it was quite interesting for us as a poultry industry when we were talking to the government departments, they were going, "You're so small, just forget about it. We haven't got time to talk to you, and it doesn't matter because your contribution is infinitesimal."
Yeah.
So we went, great. And it's true. For greenhouse gases and water usage, poultry is just so far ahead of the rest of the other meat proteins. So that's a plus. And I guess it's that plus against the risk of highly pathogenic avian influenza.
Yeah. Oh, man.
It's a worldwide trend, isn't it?
Yeah, exactly.
It's time for our famous three. We want to thank the innovative companies and products whose support and trust make this podcast possible.
Boehringer Ingelheim. Health experts bring industry-leading knowledge and expertise to today's poultry producers to help them solve challenging health issues through smart, science-driven decision-making using the best resources available. Probiotech International, creating the next generation of feed and water additives to improve animal nutrition, health, and well-being. Innovation is in our nature. Visit probiotech.com/EN for more information. Evonik, we are sciencing the global food challenge. Adiseo provides nutritional solutions and services to help producers achieve their targets in a high-quality, safe, and sustainable way. Making life easier for animals and those who care for them is the mission of Jeffo. Evonik Animal Nutrition is committed to ensure food security and safety while reducing the ecological footprint of animal farming. Its products and services use evidence-based solutions that seek to promote animal welfare and reduce reliance on natural resources. All this is underpinned by long-standing industry partnerships and deep customer understanding. Evonik's focus on efficiency, sustainable, healthy nutrition, and collaborations with livestock farming partners creates value for customers and consumers.
So before we wrap up, I want to ask you the three questions that we ask all of our guests.
Oh, yes.
And the first one is do you have a favorite poultry-related resource that you use regularly?
You know, in this country, we have an organization called the New Zealand Food Safety Science Research Center, and we've just done some very interesting work with them on genome sequencing of Campylobacter strains. And that's been hugely interesting to identify where the issue, you know, where maybe Campylobacter is. And so, yeah, that's probably our major resource. It identified for us. We thought we had cleaned the sheds out well, but it identified for us that after shed cleaning, Campylobacter strains were still there. So we're going to have to, we're doing another study to say, how can we improve our shed cleanup?
Yeah. Oh, that's great. The second question is do you have a favorite non-poultry related resource?
I guess like a lot of people, I'm getting into podcasts.
Yeah.
So a little bit on that, but I am very, and have always been, I'm a big book reader. So I love reading books. So a bit in crime novels. I love the American authors, James Lee Burke and Michael Connelly, but also like I've just finished reading a book is called Weird. Well, that's not the correct full title, but it's a study of mankind and why Western educated explains how Christianity, Western civilization, individualism, all those things have led to pretty much the world order that we have now. And it's really fascinating, actually.
Yeah, that does sound really interesting.
I should have had the book and the title.
No, it's okay.
I think it was a New York Times bestseller for a number of months. So I think if people who know about it will know what the book is. So yeah,
yes,
reading is reading on just about anything is my
I have to check that out.
Yeah,
love that.
Watching the Olympics has been good.
Oh, heck yeah. They've been a great source of entertainment recently. I love watching all the different Olympics. So, the last question is what's your best advice for someone to be successful in the poultry industry?
In my practice, and this comes from working a number of trade associations, is try and identify the trends that are coming and then pull together the information and put that to your industry and say to your industry, these trends are coming. The regulators will want to do something about it. If you don't want more regulation, let's be proactive as an industry and go and get ahead of the curve. And so I'd like to think that on a number of occasions with the number of the big issues coming, we have managed to do that. Some sectors better than others. The poultry meat sector here has been extremely good at doing that. They've and external consultants have identified that as an industry, the board has been very good at cooperation outside the marketplace, I hasten to add, but outside the marketplace, looking at issues that are arising and saying, let's do this for New Zealand Poultry Inc., shall we say, incorporated. That this is not a company, let's get a jump on somebody else. This is for the benefit of all. And I think for industries, look to your trade associations and look to be proactive and cooperative so you're not allowing the regulator to drive how you operate. You drive how you operate. So
yeah,
that's my view.
That's great advice. Forward thinking can pay off.
Doesn't always. I'm not saying it always works, but it's worked enough occasions to be good.
Heck yeah, yeah. Getting ahead of things you might see happening is smart.
But it's often hard. Change is extremely hard. I get that. And industries will often go, well, this will cost money. Why would I do that unless I have to? And you just got to get the point across. Well, it will happen at some point. So you can try as much to control your destiny. Don't let somebody else drive it.
Well, thank you so much for talking today. I love hearing about some of the things that are just in other countries and the things they're dealing with, because poultry is, I mean, it's global. It's an awesome industry to be in. So I love hearing about some of these other countries. So thank you so much.
Okay. Thank you. I really enjoyed it. Okay. Thanks, Tiffany. Bye-bye.
Do you feel overwhelmed with mundane tasks that eat up your valuable time? It's time to reclaim your schedule and focus on what truly matters. Get your time back with Elite Remote Talent without a time zone hassle. Delegate $10 an hour tasks to focus on your $1,000 an hour tasks. Schedule your free strategy call at wisevas.io.